Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I want to start today with a bit of a thought experiment. It's something that really kept me up last night after I finished reading through this massive stack of papers you sent over.
I have a feeling I know exactly where you're going with this.
I want you to just look at your hand, or, you know, just think about your own body for a second. We like to think of ourselves as the absolute pinnacle of land-based evolution.
Right. We build cities, we walk upright. We are terrestrial creatures.
Strictly terrestrial.
Yeah.
Or so we like to believe.
Exactly.
But, and this is really the core of what we're digging into today, what if that isn't entirely true? What if, buried deep inside your brainstem, in the oldest, most primitive wiring of your nervous system, there's a dormant switch?
A switch that's not for land.
Not at all. A switch that's designed for the crushing pressures of the deep ocean.
A survival reflex that we share with seals, with whales, with otters.
It's just sitting there waiting. And the papers we're covering today. Well, they ask a terrifying question. What happens when that switch gets flipped by accident?
What happens when your body thinks it's 100 meters deep in the ocean?
But you're actually safe in your own bed.
It's a question that takes us from evolutionary biology straight into the heart of one of the most baffling mysteries in neurology. It challenges how we view our own physiology.
Today, we are deep diving into the groundbreaking work of Dr. Jose L. Vega. And we're talking about a phenomenon that I, frankly, didn't know nearly enough about until I read this. We're talking about SUDEP.
SUDEP, S-U-D-E-P, sudden unexpected death in epilepsy.
And we really need to pause here on the pronunciation and the gravity of this. It's pronounced SUDEP, like one word.
SUDEP, yeah.
And looking at the sources, this isn't some rare medical footnote. This is a massive silent tragedy.
It is. And to really get the importance of the papers we're analyzing today, you have to understand the sheer frustration that doctors and families have felt about SUDEP for decades. It's been a complete black box.
Let's define it properly before we get into the mechanism.
Yeah.
Because the definition itself is, well, it's haunting.
It's what we call a diagnosis of exclusion. Basically, imagine you have a person with epilepsy who is, for all intents and purposes, healthy.
Young, strong heart, no other diseases.
Right. And then one day, they're found dead.
So the medical examiner steps in. They do the full autopsy.
They do. They check for a stroke. Negative. They check for a heart attack. You know, a blockage in the arteries. Negative.
Trauma, poison, drowning.
All negative. When you have ruled out every single known anatomical cause of death, what you are left with is SUEP.
It's a ghost. It is a death without a visible weapon.
That's a great way to put it. And the prevalence is just staggering. The sources highlight that people with epilepsy die suddenly about 24 to 28 times more frequently than the general population.
28 times. That is a statistic that is hard to wrap your head around. It's not a small margin.
No, it's the leading cause of epilepsy-related mortality. And the most terrifying aspect, the silent aspect that Dr. Vega's work focuses on, is that it almost always happens during sleep.
That's the nightmare scenario, isn't it? A family member goes to sleep, they have a seizure in the night, which maybe they've had 100 times before.
100 times, but this time, they just don't wake up.
And for decades, the medical community has been staring at this mystery. Why does a healthy heart just stop? Why do the lungs fail? The machinery looks perfect, but the engine just cuts out.
Well, today we might actually have a map to open that black box. We are exploring a hypothesis called the ictal mammalian dive response.
Ictal being the medical term for
pertaining to a seizure.
So the seizure-induced dive response. And before we go any further, we need to drop our disclaimer. We're always meticulous about this on the Deep Dive.
Absolutely. We have to be. We're analyzing a scientific hypothesis. Now, Dr. Vegas has compiled some incredibly compelling evidence, physiological mechanisms, historical data, clinical studies, but this is not yet the universal, stamped, and approved medical consensus.
It's a powerful working theory, but it's still a theory. So if you have epilepsy or you love someone who does, we are not here to scare you.
Not at all.
We're here to explore a mechanism. Because, as Dr. Vega argues, if we can understand the mechanics, if we can see the gears turning, then maybe we can find a way to stick a wrench in them. We can prevent this.
Knowledge is leverage. That is the goal here. We want to understand the why so we can change the outcome.
So let's start the detective story. Because one of my favorite things about this packet of research is that it doesn't start in a sterile hospital room. It doesn't start with a pipette in a lab.
No. It starts in a living room in front of a television.
It starts with Dr. Jose Vega, a neurologist, just watching the news.
Right. So picture this. It's Dr. Vega. He's a neurologist. So his brain is already wired to look for danger signals. You know, he spends his life treating brains that are in trouble, dealing with respiratory arrest and critical care.
So he's seen the worst case scenarios.
He's seen them. And he's watching a news segment on death-defying free dives.
Okay, now for those who haven't fallen down the YouTube rabbit hole of free diving, paint the picture for us. What are we looking at?
We are looking at a human being taking a single breath of air, just one massive inhale, and then descending into the abyss. We're talking depths of 100 meters or more.
No oxygen tank. No backup gear.
Just their lungs and willpower against the ocean. And the pressure. Immense pressure. And Vega is watching this diver go down.
And as a doctor, he's got this checklist in his head of what should be happening.
Exactly. He knows about hypoxia. He knows that when oxygen levels drop, the human body usually panics. The air hunger alarm bell should be ringing off the hook.
Your brain should be screaming, breathe now.
It should be. But Vega watches this diver at the bottom of the ocean, and the diver isn't panicking. He's not gasping. He looks calm.
Tranquil,
even.
And that's the glitch in the matrix for Vega. He's thinking, how is this person not dead? Or at least, how are they not surfacing with massive brain damage?
It just defies the standard medical logic of oxygen deprivation equals panic. So Vega, and I love this about him, he doesn't just go to the library. He doesn't just write a paper. He decides he needs to feel this for himself.
He goes full method actor on this research.
He really does. He enrolls in a recreational freediving course. He puts on the wetsuit. He gets in the water.
I can only imagine the instructor. You've got this class of thrill seekers and then a neurologist in the corner taking notes on his own physiology.
Probably. But it's in this class that the instructor drops the bomb. The instructor, who is definitely not a doctor, starts explaining the physiology of diving. He talks about something called the mammalian dive response, or MDR.
And this is the aha moment.
This is the light bulb. The instructor explains that when a mammal's face hits cold water and they hold their breath, this powerful hardwired reflex kicks in. It's automatic. The body fundamentally changes how it operates to preserve life.
And Vega sitting there thinking, I went to medical school for years. I'm a specialist. Why on earth am I learning this from a guy in a wetsuit?
It's a massive blind spot in modern medicine. I mean, doctors learn about parts of it. They might learn about diving bradycardia, the slowing of the heart, but usually as a curiosity, a party trick.
Or a technique to stop a racing heart in the ER.
Right. But they rarely study it as a holistic integrated survival system. So Vega decides to test it himself. He needs to verify this isn't just, you know, freediver folklore. He needs his own data.
So he gets in the pool.
Gets in the pool. He holds his breath. He submerses his face and he measures his own pulse.
Let's talk about the numbers here, because this is where it gets really visceral. What's a normal resting heart rate for a healthy adult?
You're looking at, what, 60 to 100 beats per minute? Maybe 60 if you're relaxed and athletic.
Okay, so 60 BPM, Vega goes under. What happens?
He feels his heart slow down. Not just a little bit. It decelerates. It drops to 30, then 20. Hmm. And finally, he clocks it at 12 beats per minute.
12. One beat every 5 seconds.
Boom, boom, boom. It's, yeah.
That is terrifying.
Yeah.
If I were a doctor and I saw a monitor reading 12, I'm grabbing the crash cart. I am charging the paddles.
Immediately. In a hospital, a heart rate of 12 is called agonal. It usually means the patient is dying right now. It precedes cardiac arrest.
But here's the paradox. Vega feels fine.
He feels better than fine. He describes it as being enwrapped by tranquility. He's in a state of, like, suspended animation, perfectly preserved by this reflex. The body has shut down everything non-essential to save the brain.
It's a low-power mode for the human body.
Precisely. But then, the story takes a dark turn. Because while this reflex is meant to save you, Vega starts to realize it has a potential cost. He starts looking into the tragedies of the freediving world.
And he finds the case of Nick Mavoli.
Nick Mavoli, an elite, world-class American freediver. He was attempting a record. He went deep. He came back up. But when he surfaced, he collapsed. And he died.
And this is where the detective work bridges that gap between the ocean and the epilepsy clinic. Vega gets his hands on Mavoli's autopsy report.
And what he sees just stops him in his tracks. Mavoli didn't have a heart attack. He didn't have a stroke. His autopsy showed he had wet lungs.
Wet lungs? What does that mean?
Pulmonary edema and hemorrhage. His lungs were heavy, waterlogged, and full of blood. Effectively, he drowned in his own body fluids.
And Vega has seen this picture before.
He's seen it in his own field. He's seen it in the autopsies of young, healthy people who died of CCD.
The negative autopsy we talked about earlier. It isn't fully negative, is it?
No, that's the thing. The heart looks fine, structurally, But the lungs. The lungs in CDT patients are often heavy, congested, and edematous, just like the freediver.
So the hypothesis clicks into place. You have two completely different groups of people, freedivers and people with epilepsy.
Right. They both stop breathing, one voluntarily, one because of a seizure. They both have this potential for lethal lung damage.
And the question becomes, is the body reacting to the seizure as if it were a deep dive? Is SUTEEV actually a misplaced lethal activation of this mammalian dive response?
Is the body trying so hard to save the brain that it ends up destroying the lungs and stopping the heart?
That is the ictal mammalian dive response hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And to understand how that could happen, we have to look under the hood. But before we get to the mechanics, we have to correct some history.
Yes, I was hoping we'd get to this. Because in his research, Vega finds out that the history books and even the medical textbooks have been giving credit to the wrong guy for discovering this response.
And correcting this history actually changes how we understand the mechanism itself.
It really does. This is a fascinating detour into the history of science. Usually the history books credit Paul Bert, a French physiologist in the 1870s, with discovering diving bradycardia, that slowing of the heart rate.
But Vega, again, doing his own detective work, digging through archives, realizes Bert's experiment was, well, it was flawed.
Flawed is a polite way to put it. Bert was studying drowning. He submerged ducks and kept them under until they died.
So he wasn't studying a reflex.
No. He noted that their heart rates slowed down massively before the end. He was measuring the heart rate of a dying animal.
A dying heart slows down. That's just,
He actually attributed the duck's survival time to their total blood volume, not the heart rate change. He completely missed the point.
So who is the real hero here? And I want to be crystal clear, because the sources are, it wasn't historians of science that dug this up. It was Dr. Vega himself, following the threads of his research, who brought this person back to light.
Correct. Vega's work uncovered the thesis of Edmund Goodwin, a British medical student writing in 1786, nearly a century before Bert.
1786, that's ancient in medical terms.
Oh.
We're talking about an era where medicine was barely a science. What did Goodwin do differently?
He was brilliant. He used a toad. He submerged the toad with its chest open so he could view the heart directly. He saw the heart rate slowing down drastically during the immersion, just like Bert saw. But, and this is the absolute key, he pulled the toad out before it died.
And the toad recovered.
Fully. Goodwin wrote in his thesis that the toad walked about without any expressions of uneasiness. The heart rate went right back to normal.
So he proved it was a reversible reflex.
A survival mechanism, not just the slow fate of death. And it's amazing that this was lost for 100 years. But for our purposes, establishing that this is a survival mechanism is critical. The body does this to save the brain.
Okay, let's unpack that mechanism. Mm-hmm. What exactly is the mammalian dive response?
Yeah.
We've mentioned the heart rate slowing down, but there's more to it.
It's a triad of reflexes, a whole suite of them, triggered primarily by apnea holding your breath and facial contact with cold water, which stimulates the trigeminal nerve.
Okay, so component number one, diving bradycardia. We covered this with Vega's 12 beats per minute.
Right. The vagus nerve fires, slowing the heart rate way, way down. The purpose is simple. Economize. The heart is a muscle. If it beats slower, it consumes less oxygen. You're saving the battery life, so to speak.
Makes sense. Component number two, peripheral vasoconstriction.
This is where the body starts playing favorites. The blood vessels in the periphery, your arms, your legs, your skin, they clamp down tight. The body effectively says, sorry, fingers and toes, you don't need oxygen right now. The brain and the heart come first.
It shunts all the blood away from the limbs and towards the core.
To the vital organs. And that leads us to component number three, the blood shift. This seems to be the absolute smoking gun for the SEDP theory.
Okay, so what is the blood shift?
It's physics, really. You constrict all those vessels in your limbs, that blood has to go somewhere. It can't just vanish. So it gets shifted into the chest cavity, the cardiopulmonary vasculature, the heart and the lungs. It's a massive movement of blood volume.
Now, I have to stop us here for a second, because in some of the older literature, and even in some of the source material we looked at initially, there's talk about a spleen contraction being part of this response.
Yes, and we need to address that firmly because it's a common misconception, and Dr. Vega's analysis is very, very specific about this. It's a critical point to get right.
So let's clear the air. Does the spleen contract in humans during this response to release more red blood cells?
No, emphatically no.
Mm.
In some animals, like seals or dogs, yes, absolutely. Their spleen acts like a biological subatank, squeezing out oxygen-rich red blood cells into the circulation.
It's an extra oxygen boost for them. but in humans.
In humans, an active spleen contraction like that does not exist. Yeah. There is zero evidence for it.
Why not? Is it just that we lost the ability through evolution?
It really comes down to basic anatomy and physiology. First, the human spleen is not a muscle. It has a capsule, sure, but it lacks the necessary smooth muscle fibers required to actively squeeze down. It physically cannot contract.
So the whole idea is based on a flawed anatomical assumption.
It is. But there's another reason it doesn't make sense for humans. In us, the spleen acts more like a cemetery for red blood cells.
A cemetery.
It's where old and damaged red blood cells go to die or get recycled. The cells that are stored in the spleen are often senescent, maybe a bit dysfunctional.
So even if you could squeeze it, you'd just be releasing a bunch of old zombie blood cells into your system.
Exactly. You'd be dumping low-performance, dysfunctional cells into the bloodstream right when you need high-performance oxygen carriers the most. It just wouldn't help you survive a dive. So for the purpose of our SUDP discussion, we need to take the spleen completely off the table. It is not a factor in humans.
Got it. No spleen scuba tank for us.
Mm.
So let's go back to the blood shift. If the spleen isn't involved, what is driving this massive movement of blood during a seizure? And more importantly, why is the blood moving? What is the reflex trying to accomplish?
This is where we have to look at the muscles. And this is a truly crucial insight from Vega's work. Think about a generalized tonic-clonic seizure, or a GTCS.
The type of seizure most people picture from movies. Convulsions, thrashing, muscle rigidity.
Right. Every muscle in the body is contracting violently. And because it's a seizure, there is no cortical control. The brain isn't telling the muscles to move in a coordinated way. They are just firing wildly.
And the muscles that are working that hard need fuel. They need oxygen.
They need massive amounts of it. They become oxygen vampires. But remember, during the seizure, the person isn't breathing. They are in apnea.
So you have a limited and rapidly dwindling supply of oxygen.
And the muscles are trying to steal all of it.
So the reflex kicks in to stop the fat.
That is the goal. The mammalian dive response is, at its heart, a brain protection mechanism. To save the brain, it has to cut off the competition. It clamps down the blood vessels to those thrashing muscles to stop them from draining the body's last reserves of oxygen.
It's ruthless efficiency. It shunts the blood away from the muscles, even though they're screaming for it.
And that blood rushes into the chest. It floods the lungs and the heart. That is the blood shift. It's moving the blood supply to a safe house, away from the metabolically expensive muscles.
Okay, so let's put all of this together into the ictal MDR hypothesis.
Yeah.
We have a patient having a major seizure. Walk us through the perfect storm.
Okay. Scenario. A generalized tonic-clonic seizure starts. Two things happen almost immediately. One, the patient stops breathing. Apnea. Two, vigorous, uncontrolled muscle activity.
Now, normally, the MDR happens when we are diving. But Vega argues that a seizure perfectly mimics a dive.
It mimics a very specific, very dangerous kind of dive. Think about it. It's apnea plus vigorous exercise. If you hold your breath and just sit on the couch, you can last a while. But if you hold your breath and sprint,
you burn through your oxygen in seconds.
Mm-hmm.
The body panics.
The body panics and it ramps up the reflex. It's called an augmented MDR. The combination of apnea and muscle thrashing makes the reflex exponentially stronger than a normal, calm dive. But here's the kicker. It is unfettered.
Unfettered, meaning uncontrolled.
Completely uncontrolled. When a freediver dives, their brain is active, they're conscious, the cortex, the thinking part of the brain can modulate the response. It can keep things in check.
But in a seizing patient?
The cortex is offline. It's suppressed by the electrical storm of the seizure.
So the reflex just runs wild. There is no brake pedal.
It is all gas. The brainstem sees the apnea, sees the oxygen dropping, and it slams the save the brain button with maximum unregulated force.
And that leads to the pathological outcome. Let's talk about the lungs first, the damage there.
The massive blood shift. You have this incredible surge of blood volume slamming into the delicate vasculature of the lungs. The pressure inside those tiny vessels skyrockets.
And we're talking about capillaries, microscopic blood vessels. They aren't designed for that kind of pressure.
Not at all. Think of them like old plumbing in a house. If you suddenly blast a fire hose through a garden hose, what happens?
It's going to burst. Or at least leak everywhere.
It bursts. The capillaries rupture or become leaky. Fluid and blood are forced out of the vessels and into the air sacs, the alveoli. This is neurogenic pulmonary edema.
The patient is effectively drowning in their own body fluids.
Exactly. And this matches the autopsy findings in sooty kid cases perfectly. Heavy, wet lungs. The lungs become useless for gas exchange right when the patient needs them most.
But the lungs aren't the only victim here. The heart is also in deep trouble. And this part is fascinating because it involves two systems fighting each other to the death.
This is the second potential mechanism of death, autonomic conflict. Imagine driving a car. Your foot is stomping on the gas, but your other foot is stomping on the brake at the exact same time.
The gas pedal is the sympathetic system.
Yes. The seizure itself is a massive sympathetic storm, fight or flight. It's screaming at the heart, speed up, beat faster, we are convulsing, we need blood flow.
And the brake pedal is the MDR.
The parasympathetic system, the vagus nerve. The apnea triggers it to scream, slow down, conserve oxygen, stop beating so fast.
So the heart is getting a go signal and a stop signal at the exact same time.
And the electrical system of the heart just can't handle that confusion. It creates electrical chaos. It can go into a fatal arrhythmia, either a systole, which is a flat line, or ventricular fibrillation.
And that's the sudden part of sudden unexpected death.
That is the hypothesis. A perfect storm of a survival reflex gone wrong. The body tries to save the brain from hypoxia, but in doing so, it destroys the lungs and stops the heart.
It makes so much sense when you lay it out like that. But of course, a good hypothesis needs evidence. We've talked about the wet lungs, but are there other clues? Things that doctors might have been seeing for years but not understanding?
There is a big one, and it's hiding in plain sight. It's in the blood work. White blood cells.
Okay, so doctors usually check white blood cell counts for infection, right?
Correct. If your white count is high, you probably have the flu or pneumonia, some kind of infection. But doctors have noticed for a long time that after a major seizure, patients often have a huge unexplained spike in their white blood cells.
They call it post-convulsive leukocytosis,
right,
which is a fancy way of saying high white cells after a seizure.
Right. And often doctors see this and think, oh, the patient must have an underlying infection that caused the seizure. They start antibiotics, they go looking for bacteria.
But Vega says it is not an infection at all.
He says it's the blood shift again. We need to explain a concept called demargination. This is really cool physiology.
Okay, let's unpack that. Demargination.
Okay. Imagine your blood vessels are like a river. In the middle of the river, the water flows fast and clear. That's your main circulation. But along the banks, the margins, the water is slower, it's sticky, maybe a little muddy.
And that's where the white blood cells are hanging out.
About 50 to 60% of your white blood cells are normally marginated. They are stuck to the walls of the tiny capillaries, especially in the lungs. They are just parked there, like barnacles on a ship or sediment on the riverbank.
So they aren't circulating. If you drew blood from a vein, you wouldn't count them because they aren't in the main flow.
Exactly. They're off to the side. But remember the blood shift. The ictal MDR sends a massive rush of blood through the lungs with high pressure, what we call high shear force.
It's like opening a dam and flushing the entire river.
It flushes out the banks, it scours the walls, it sweeps all those parked, marginated white blood cells back into the main circulation.
So when you draw blood, 5 or 10 minutes later,
the count is suddenly sky high. Not because the body magically made new cells, that takes days, but because all the hidden ones were flushed out by the pressure wave.
Vega actually did a study on this, didn't he? To test this idea.
He did a retrospective study, and this is the fascinating part. He found that the magnitude of the white blood cell spike correlated directly with the severity of the respiratory compromise.
So, in other words, the longer the patient stopped breathing,
the higher their white blood cell count went. Because the longer apnea drove a stronger MDR, which caused a stronger blood shift, which flushed out more cells from the lungs.
It's a footprint.
It is a physiological footprint of the dive response. The white cell count isn't a sign of infection. It's a barometer telling you how violent the blood shift was.
There was one other piece of evidence mentioned in the papers, lactic acid.
Right. We've known for a long time that seizures cause lactic acidosis. It makes sense. Muscles work hard without enough oxygen. They produce lactate. But the MDR theory adds a crucial nuance.
Because the MDR actively cuts off blood flow to the muscles.
Exactly. If the reflex shunts blood away from the muscles to save the brain, those muscles are completely cut off. They are forced to switch to anaerobic metabolism-making energy without any oxygen at all.
Which produces way more lactic acid than just normal exercise would.
It mirrors exactly what happens in deep-diving mammals like seals. They surface with sky-high lactate levels because their muscles were completely isolated from the blood supply during the dive. It's another piece of evidence consistent with the theory that the muscles are being cut off during the seizure.
Okay, so we have a mechanism. We have evidence. Now let's talk about the real-world implications. Who is at risk? What are the risk factors for CESU-AP?
The sources identify some very clear risk factors, and the biggest one by far is having generalized tonic-clonic seizures, the big convulsive ones.
Which fits the theory perfectly. You need that violent muscle thrashing to augment the reflex and cause the massive blood shift. A quiet, staring spell seizure wouldn't do it.
Precisely. The mechanism requires that kind of seizure. Another huge risk factor, lack of supervision at night.
Because if no one is there to stimulate you or wake you up as you come out of it,
the reflex continues unchecked. The apnea continues. And the third one is absolutely crucial. Prone position, being face down when the seizure occurs.
Why does face down matter so much? I mean, is it just about simple suffocation in a pillow?
Suffocation is certainly part of it, obstructing the airway. But think about the triggers for the dive response we mentioned earlier. Apnea, yes, but also
facial contact with water.
Facial contact, pressure on the face. Stimulation of the trigeminal nerve.
Oh, wow. So being face down in a pillow.
It mimics the sensory input of face immersion. It powerfully stimulates that trigeminal nerve.
It tricks the brainstem into thinking we are underwater.
And if you are already seizing an apneic, that powerful sensory input might be the final push that triggers the lethal cascade. It reinforces the signal to dive, dive, dive.
This brings us back to the autopsy paradox.
Yeah.
You mentioned the negative autopsy, how the heart looks structurally fine.
Structurally, yes. But the lungs are heavy and wet. And here is a detail Dr. Vega points out that is often missed in autopsy reports. The heart chambers are often found to be empty, squeezed completely dry, while the lungs are totally engorged with blood.
That paints such a vivid, tragic picture. The heart pumped everything it had into the lungs, and then it just stopped.
It fits the perfect storm scenario to a T. Seizure starts. Apnea begins. The MDR triggers to save the brain. Blood shifts to the lungs. Pulmonary edema sets in. The autonomic conflict stops the heart.
So the patient doesn't die from the seizure per se, not from the electricity in the brain.
They die from the body's overaggressive, unfettered attempt to survive the lack of oxygen caused by the seizure. It is biological friendly fire.
That is heavy. It is incredibly tragic. But it's also hopeful, isn't it? Because if we move from unexplained mystery to physiological mechanism, we can actually do something about it.
Absolutely. If SUDO is caused by a physiological reflex, then we can interrupt it. We can treat it. We can prevent it.
What are the potential interventions? If this hypothesis holds true, how do we stop it?
Well, oxygen seems to be the big one. The primary trigger for the MDR is apnea and hypoxia. If you can administer oxygen during or immediately after a seizure, you might break that hypoxic trigger.
You're telling the brainstem, hey, we're okay, we have air, you can stand down, don't dump all the blood into the lungs.
Exactly. You abort the signal before the cascade gets going.
What about simple stimulation?
Touching, shaking, stimulating the patient. We know from animal studies and even from Goodwin's dry land toad experiments back in the 1700s that lung inflation or strong sensory input can abort the MDR.
So if a family member sees a seizure, just being there, talking to them, touching them as they come out of it, could potentially save their life.
It stimulates the sympathetic nervous system in a different way, or it helps engage the cortex, helping to override that primitive brainstem reflex. It takes the foot off the brake. It tells the body, we are on land. We are safe.
It really emphasizes the tragedy of the unwitnessed seizure and why night monitoring is so critical for high-risk patients.
It does. Supervision is key. If you can break the apnea, if you can provide that stimulation, you might prevent the entire cascade.
I want to circle back to Edmund Goodwin for just a moment, the man who started this whole thing in 1786.
Goodwin was a visionary. He wasn't just observing. He warned against the term suspended animation. He said, "This isn't magic. This is a disease of the lungs. It is asphyxia."
And he was already arguing for artificial ventilation back then.
He was, at a time when others were using, well, tobacco smoke enemas. Yes, that was a real accepted treatment for drowning back then, yeah. Blowing smoke. Well, you know where.
I am very, very glad we have moved past that particular era of medicine.
Me too. But the point is, Goodwin was right then. He said, we need to ventilate the lungs to restore life. And his work might be right now. Preventing the apnea, maybe even ventilating the patient, could be the key to solving SUDOE.
It really brings it full circle. We're using 18th century physiological insights to solve a 21st century mystery.
It just shows that knowledge isn't always linear. Sometimes you have to look back to move forward. Dr. Vega's work is a testament to that. He didn't just accept the textbook answer. He went back to the source. He looked at the anomalies.
So what does this all mean for our listeners?
Yeah.
Especially if they or someone they love has epilepsy.
First, don't panic. SEDP is a risk. But understanding a potential mechanism empowers you. Talk to your neurologist. Ask about nocturnal supervision or monitoring devices. Focus on the best possible seizure control, because preventing the seizure in the first place prevents the reflex.
And maybe look at medical mysteries a little differently.
Right. They aren't magic. They're just physiology waiting to be decoded.
Before we sign off, I want to leave everyone with a final thought. We talk about evolution as this ladder that we climbed up. We came out of the ocean. We grew legs. We built cities.
But we never really left the ocean behind, did we?
No. We carry it within us. That neural circuitry, that ancient ability to shut everything down and dive deep, it is still there, hardwired into our brainstems.
It's a survival tool. It allowed our mammalian ancestors to forage underwater, to survive hypoxic crises. It is part of why we are here today.
But in the unique, violent electrical storm of epilepsy, that same tool that was designed to save us might be the very thing that turns against us. It is a biological double-edged sword.
And understanding that our evolutionary past is active and alive in our present could be the key to saving thousands of lives.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. It has been a fascinating journey from the coral reef all the way to the neurology clinic.
It certainly has. Keep asking questions.
We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.